someday. Oh, dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way to.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm, and you are listening to one of my very favorite songs in the world, Moon River. Singing it is one of the most beautiful voices in the world. He was declared a national treasure by President Ronald Reagan, and Andy Williams' voice still works magic. It oozes romance. When we listen, the world seems to turn just a bit more slowly. Andy Williams joins me in the studio. We're going to talk about his new book, Moon River and Me. Williams, it's so good to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you, too.
Thank you. You've been singing that song for a long time.
A long, long time.
Do you remember the very, very first time you sang it?
Well, the first time I sang it in public was on the Academy Awards. It was in 1962. It had just been in the movie called
Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Breakfast at Tiffany's with Audrey Hepburn. And I ran into Mancini and Mercer, the writers, in a restaurant called La Scala in Beverly Hills. And they had just come from recording her, and they had the music with them. So I went over to say hello to them. I had known them for a long time. And they said, this is a, I think it was Johnny Mercer that was saying, this is absolutely perfect for you. And I took it back to New York and played it for Archie Blyer, who was the head of the record company, Cadence Records. He said, I don't think it's a hit.
Really?
He had guided me into a lot of hit songs before.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I just don't think the kids will buy the line, My Huckleberry Friend. It's too sophisticated. I just don't think it. So I never recorded it. It was a hit by Henry Mancini as an instrumental. It was a hit by a vocalist named Jerry Butler. And then the next year I was asked to sing it on the Academy Awards. And I knew that it was going to be 6 weeks before I sang it. So I called Columbia. I had moved to Columbia now, Columbia Records. Told them that I was going to do it on the awards, and everybody thought it was going to win. And I said, I think we ought to go in and record Moon River and other great movie themes, put it in an album, have it in the stores the day after I sing it. And I must say Columbia did a terrific marketing job because they had it in every store.
Isn't that wonderful?
And the day after I sang it, the next day, it sold 420,000 albums. And then I put it as the theme song of my television series, which had just started. And so for 9 years on television, I sang the first four bars of it.
I love it.
For 9 years. Ooh. I became more associated with the song than either Henry Mancini, who wrote it, and recorded it, or Jerry Butler, who had a big vocal version on it.
Do you recall?
And I never put it out as a single. It was never out as a single.
Never out as a single.
So it never charted. But it was on the album charts for months and months and
months. Did you ever go back to the person who said to you, I don't think this is going to be a hit?
Well, I did. I mean, he was a friend of mine.
Yeah?
Archie Blyer, who's the head of the record company. And then a couple of years later, I understood that he was going to sell the record company, Cadence, with all my stuff on it that I'd recorded before. And I didn't want my stuff being put in drugstores, because he was selling it to Pickwick, and that's what they did, is they would take catalogs and put them in drugstores and reduce the price to like a dollar and a half or something. So I said, how much are you asking for your company? And he told me, and I said, okay, I'll buy it. So I bought the company. And then now I own all the Everly Brothers records, all of the Cordettes records, everything that was on Cadence.
It's really amazing to hear that story, because life for you started out in Wall Lake, Iowa.
That's right.
Tell me about Wall Lake, Iowa.
Well, Wall Lake was a small town, 749 people. I say that included the cemetery, which of course isn't true, but 749 people. There were several churches. Our Presbyterian church didn't have a choir, and my father formed the choir, which was my mother, my father, and my two older brothers.
And you.
And Dick later. And I later started singing at home, you know, learning those hymns. And then we went in and sang in the choir for a year. And then my father's big dream was that his boys would get on the radio and become radio stars.
You know, what surprised me most was, you know, you were born in 1927, and here you all were living in the midst of the Depression.
Right.
Living in the time of the Dust Bowl.
Right.
Living in the time of a three-hole outhouse. You had virtually nothing except your music, but you had that music, and it was so important to your mother and to your father and eventually to you.
That's true. My father was an amateur musician. He played several instruments, played piano. My mother played a little piano, and there was always music in the house. We were poor, but none of us knew it. None of the kids knew it.
Your dad had a job.
He did have a job. He was a railway mail clerk, which is a man that sorts mail on a train as it's moving and then drops bags off on each little town as they go through. Without the train stopping, an arm swings out with a sack of letters for that town. And the beginning of my book starts that way, that my father used to take me occasionally on the train with him. And when we come through Wall Lake, he'd put me in the sack. And an arm would swing out, and the sack would catch onto a hook at the railroad station. And then the station master would generally come down and open it up and take the mail back to the post office. And my mother would come down and open it up, and I would pop out and say, surprise.
Surprise. Your dad really did have ambitions for you and your brothers. He felt that you three, you could all be the ticket to some kind of fortune, some kind of fame. And he was absolutely convinced he was right.
Yeah, he was. He had four boys and wanted us to become well-known radio, because television wasn't around. Radio was the big thing.
Still is.
Yeah. Well, it is for you, yes. It is for millions and millions of people.
Exactly.
But at the time, television wasn't around. And Bing Crosby was the big thing on the radio, and as far as singers in the early years. And it was great when my father finally took us to Los Angeles to get us in the movies. My father was very much like the Osmond Brothers' father. You know, he's strict, but very kindly. He was much different than Michael Jackson's father, who was tough, mean kind of guy. But My father was gentle, but he was very strict about what we would do and what we wouldn't do.
And what he wanted to do was to move to a place where you and your brothers could perform on radio.
Right, and have a better life than we were having in Wall Lake.
Of course, you hated leaving that home in Wall Lake.
Well, I left there. I was in the third grade.
Right.
So it wasn't as instilled in me, you know, with schoolmates and all that, because I was still only about 8 years old. So it wasn't that hard for me to leave. I didn't want to leave a few friends that I had, but families do move, you know, and children do go through different schools. And we did. We went in Des Moines, Chicago, Cincinnati, Los Angeles. So as it ends up, I didn't really have school friends that I keep now today, because I moved around a little too much.
Andy Williams, his new book is titled Moon River and Me. We're going to hear Swingin' on a Stalk.
Would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long, funny ears, kicks up at anything he hears.
His back is brawny, but his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak.
And by the way, if you hate to go to school,
and we'll take just a short break in our conversation with Andy Williams. You're hearing, of course, Bing Crosby with his Swingin' on a Star. And we'll talk about that relationship when we come back.
With dirt on his face, his shoes are a terrible disgrace. He has no
But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig.
Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are?
Or would you rather be a fish?
A fish won't do anything but swim in a brook. He can't write his name or read a book. To fool the people is his only thought, and though he's slippery, he still gets caught.
But then if that sort of life is what you wish, you may grow up to be a fish. A new kind of jumped up slippery fish.
And if you've just joined us, the great entertainer, the wonderfully melodious voice of Andy Williams is in this hour. He's here in the studio with me. His new autobiography or memoir, whichever you prefer, is titled Moon River and Me. We talked in the last segment a lot about Moon River. I'd like to hear about your relationship with Bing Crosby.
Well, my father, when he took us to Des Moines, Los Angeles, and we all thought he was crazy. I mean, even I thought he was crazy then, you know. And my brother Bob was very pessimistic all the time about every move we made. Well, we can't be, you know, we can sing maybe here in Des Moines, but we certainly aren't good enough to go to Chicago, or, you know, that was always a negative thing. And so when my father said he was going to take us to California, we're going to get in the movies, we all thought he was nuts, you know, that he just...
How did your mother react to all of this?
Well, she's a, you know, she was a very kindly, loving mother that believed strongly in her husband and what he could do and what he couldn't do. And so she went along with everything very happily. And we got out to California within a couple months, we met Bing Crosby, and we had sung at a Hollywood canteen for servicemen, And I was still, you know, like 14, 13 or 14 years old. And then John Scott Trotter, who was the orchestra leader and conductor and worked with Bing on all of his records, heard us there and told Bing about us. And so then we made this record with him. He had done it in a movie called Going My Way, and he used a boys' choir from Notre Dame.
Oh, I remember that.
And whether they could get them, or I don't know why we were called in to do it, but it was wonderful singing with Bing Crosby. And I mean, we idolized him. You know, he was, at that point in his career, they say that he had about 40% of all the music, all the vocal things on the radio were Bing Crosby. I mean, he was just the king of records. Well, he was king of movies, too, at that time. He won an Academy Award. So it was a big thrill for me 20 years later to have him on my show, sitting on a stool next to Bing Crosby and singing duets with him, you know, as an equal to this man that I idolized so much.
Of course, World War II got in the way.
Yes. And my brothers were drafted. They all went in the service. I was too young. I still wasn't 17, and so I missed the war. I missed the war until I was 21. Then when I was 21, I was drafted, and at that point the war was over, and they didn't need people. They didn't need young people in the service, and I had developed an ulcer, and so I was rejected. So I never really went in the service. I was in the Merchant Marine for about 6 months. Then when we got back together after the war, then we started this act with Kay Thompson.
I want to hear about Kay Thompson. She really orchestrated your group's very successful nightclub act.
It was a absolutely wonderful new kind of act, never been done before, of a woman with four dancers and not using handheld microphones or anything,
and
because we moved around so much and did all kind of acrobatic kind of stuff. And
how did you learn to do that?
Just learned it from the choreographer, Bob Alton. Huh.
And, of course, Kay Thompson was the author of the Eloise books.
She was.
We should say that.
Did you read my book?
I read a good part of it.
You must be the most well-read woman in the world.
Well, I have an awful lot of help, Andy. Yeah. I can tell you that. But what I do know is what's in my heart, because I grew up listening to your music.
Well, I'm glad you did.
So that when I heard that Andy Williams was coming through, I was absolutely delighted to think that after all these years, I might meet you.
Well, I'm delighted to meet you.
The trouble you had was in establishing yourself as a solo performer.
That was very hard for me. I had worked with my brothers for so long, and I depended upon them. And when they decided that they wanted to do other things, and all family groups break up sometimes, and it's usually the younger one that goes on, like in the case of Donny Osmond or Michael Jackson. I was the youngest, and I didn't know what else to do, really. You know, that's all I knew.
Hmm. What did your brothers want to go on and do?
My brother Dick wanted to sing with a big band. He went with Harry James. My brother Don wanted to be an agent. He wanted to book people, and not instead of getting up on the floor, he wanted to be the one that booked the people.
So what was the hardest part for you? Was it to find the material that was right for you?
Well, it was. That was one thing. And Kay Thompson was a very sophisticated woman, and our act was a very sophisticated act, and we were playing in very sophisticated places. And so when I asked Kay if she would help me with my act, it was a very sophisticated act that she put together for me. Only I wasn't playing in sophisticated places. I was playing in dumps. I was playing in places, you know, where the miners would come in after work with their helmets still on, you know. And they didn't want to hear Mad Dogs and Englishmen and, you know, old obscure Rodgers and Hart medleys and Gershwin things. They wanted to hear pop things. Well, they wanted to hear something. I had no name, I had no record, and it was very difficult.
You tell me you love me, you say you'll be true, then you fly around with somebody new, but I'm crazy about you, you butterfly. You're treating me mean, you're making me cry. I've made up my mind to tell you goodbye, but I'm no good without you, you butterfly.
So Butterfly became one of your early hits.
Well, Archie Blyer, you know, who picked the songs for me, he said, this is a hit song, and I think you ought to do it. And I said, but this is not my style. He said, you don't have a style. You haven't made a record yet. Nobody knows you. So what do you mean it's not your style? And I said, well, I picture myself as more of a ballad singer, you know, he had given me Canadian Sunset, which was a wonderful record, melodic, and was a sort of a hit for me, not a big one, but a pretty good hit. And then he came up with this one, and I said, I just can't do this. He said, well, then I'll give it to somebody else, if you don't want a hit. I said, well, I do want a hit, but he said, then do this song. So I got an Elvis Presley record and took it home and listened to it, and I didn't mean to imitate Elvis Presley, but I wanted to get an idea of how this kind of a song would be done. So I went in the studio and said, you tell me you love me, you say you'll be true, then you know, in that same sort of style that Elvis would do. And Archie Blyer was right. It was the biggest record I ever had, single record.
Really?
Thank you so much. I know what I'll do. I'm keeping your wings. You're flying us through, cause I'm crazy about you. You butterfly. You butterfly. You butterfly.
I know we have a lot of callers waiting, but I want to hear a little more about the turning point for you. And I know that 1962, when you recorded Moon River, made a big difference. But there was another piece of music that also was part of a movie, Days of Wine and Roses.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, after I had Moon River, it was a big hit. Then naturally all the movie publishers of the movie song would come to me, either to me directly or to the producer, or in that case it would be Robert Mercy. And the minute that I had a big hit with Moon River, then I got the Days of Wine and Roses, which was also a Henry Mancini, Johnny Mercer song.
Did you like it?
Oh,
right,
I loved
away?
It. Yeah, I loved it.
I love it even now.
The days of wine and roses, laugh and run away like a child at play through a meadowland toward a closing. A door marked nevermore that wasn't there before. The lonely night discloses just a passing breeze filled with memories of the golden smile
mother thought you had won the Academy Award.
Well, after I sang Moon River on the Academy Award show, she called me. And she said, congratulations. I said, on what? She said, on winning your first Academy Award. I said, Mama, I didn't win it. You know, it was just for the song. It was a songwriter award. She said, don't tell me.
Oh.
She said, four other people got up and sang songs. And you were the best one, and you won.
That's so lovely.
So then the next year, I did Days of Wine and Roses on the Academy Awards. And that one won, too. So she called me again and said, two in a row. I don't believe anybody has done that before. Not even Walter Brennan has won two in a row, you know. I said, Mama, well, she didn't want to hear. So the next year, the Academy asked me if I'd sing Charade, also written by Mercer and things. And so I said, yes, I would do that. Then the day before the show, they said to me that Debbie Reynolds was supposed to do, Call Me Irresponsible. And she was ill, and could I do that too? So I said, yeah, I could do that. So I sang two songs of the five being nominated, and Call Me Irresponsible won. So now my mother, until the day she died, she thought I'd won three Academy Awards.
I love that story. And Andy Williams is with me. His new memoir titled Moon River and Me. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got a lot of callers, shall we?
Sure.
Hear what they have to say. Let's go first to Norman, who's in Palm City, Florida. Good morning to you, sir. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I wanted to ask Andy Williams why Moon River has become such a popular hit at Christmas time. It's not a Christmas song. It has nothing to do with Christmas.
No, it doesn't. You know, I hadn't thought about it being a particular popular at Christmas time, but I guess it's just such a pretty melody. It's such a beautiful song.
And I think it has to do with dreams and sort of imagination and...
And possibly because I am so known for Christmas that maybe people play that too, you know.
Absolutely. Andy Williams, how does it feel to sit here and hear that voice of yours from those years ago?
Well, when I made them, you know, I didn't think too much about them. Years and years later, you know, I listen to them occasionally, like today. I don't play my records at home, so I don't hear them unless I'm on a show like yours, or if I happen to hear it on the radio. And I like it. You know, I like the sound of it. I like the arrangements, and I like the sound of my voice. But I didn't particularly like them when I did them. I mean, I didn't think they were that outstanding.
Did you have a little later on some difficulty with your voice? You talked with Julie Andrews about.
I did talk to Julie Andrews because she had a vocal problem and
right.
had an operation that didn't really work too well for her. So I called her and I said, "What do you think I should do?" Because I have a node on my throat, and I know that's what you had, and I'm just calling you for some advice. And she said, don't use my doctor. So I said, okay. She said, go see a guy at UCLA in California. Gave me his name. And I'm very grateful to him still because he's the one that said, I wouldn't operate it on it. Said I'd give it a 3 months of just rest. Don't use it. Don't sing. And if it goes down some, if it goes away a little bit, that means it will go away on itself, on its own. If it doesn't, then maybe we should consider an operation on it, but I wouldn't do it now. And so after 3 months, it had gone down a lot. And he said, can you stay off from singing, away from singing for another, say, 6 months? And I said, yeah, I will. So I just didn't work for a year. And it went away completely. So I was very lucky that way.
And she had great difficulty after the operation that she had.
Yeah, she did.
But are you still singing?
Oh, I sing every day. I shouldn't say every day. I just finished the Christmas show that I do in my theater in Branson, Missouri, which is from November 1st until this year. It was December 8th. Next year it'll be the 1st of November until December 13th. But yeah, and then before that, working too.
Andy Williams, Moon River and Me, his memoir.
Guess there's no use in hanging around. Guess I'll get dressed and...
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the new face of imprisonment in America. We talk with journalist Tom Barry about his investigation into public-private prisons in remote areas along the southwest border where legal and illegal immigrants are held, often far away from their families and their lawyers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you. You'd be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off. Pardon the way that I stay. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak. There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that.
If you've just joined us, Andy Williams is with me. We're talking about his new memoir. It's titled Moon River and Me. Tell me about your relationship with Bobby Kennedy and the fact that you were there in Los Angeles when he died.
Yeah. Claudine and I were very close with Ethel and Bobby. We went skiing with him in Sun Valley. I went on a river trip with him. We stayed with him occasionally when we were in Virginia, McLean. We just became very good friends. I never talked to him about politics because I knew, you know, so little about it. And we talked about families, and we talked about golf, and we talked about tennis, and we talked about anything except politics. And one time he asked me if I would become a delegate for him from the state of California. He said, I've asked Shirley MacLaine, and I'd like you to be a delegate. And I said, sure, I'd love it. And then about two or three weeks later, I called him. I said, I hope I haven't embarrassed you or will embarrass you or anything, or have done something that really stupid, but I can't be a delegate for you. And he said, why not? I said, because I'm a Republican. And he laughed. And he said, well, if you'll do it, I would still like you to do it, if you'll just go down and become a Democrat until I get in. Then you can go back being a Republican if you want. That was as close as we ever got to talking about politics.
But then you were there.
I was there. Claudia and I were there with Ethel the night that he was killed at the Ambassador Hotel. And we were supposed to meet to have dinner after he left the stage there.
You were watching on television.
Yeah, we were watching on television. And then we went down and you know, instead of going to dinner, obviously, we were going to go to the hospital where he was, which we eventually found out where he was. It was a madhouse. It was really a madhouse there after he was shot, with panic and people screaming and yelling. And it was a nightmare. And finally, when we got to the hospital, we stayed the night at the hospital. And then early the next morning, Claudine and I went in to see him, because we thought he was right behind this door where we were waiting. And when we finally opened the door, knocked and nobody answered, opened the door, it was just a doorway to a hall. And then we walked down the hallway, and there was a room with the door open, and Bobby and Ethel were in there. Ethel was passed out, was lying on the cot next to him. And he had all kinds of tubes in him, obviously, and he was red, absolutely red, all over. His head and hair and everything was red. And he was already gone. And then after after it was announced that he was dead, then we got on the plane that took him to New York City. We had no clothes or anything. We just got on it and would get some when we got to New York. And then a couple of days later, I sang at the funeral, sang the battle hymn.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory. Sounded forth the trumpet that shall never come retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory. On. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
for a long while, you couldn't listen to that.
Well, I couldn't. I couldn't sing it again, but I can listen to it now. It's John Glenn and I, the night before the funeral, went to, we were at Gene Smith's, Bobby's sister's apartment in New York, and we looked it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I picked out three verses and wrote them down. I hadn't memorized them, so I read them. You know, I had a sheet in front of me looking at them, just my handwriting, you know. Monsignor Duffy wanted me to sing Panis Angelicus and a couple other Catholic songs that I didn't know, because I wasn't brought up as a Catholic. And I didn't know these songs, and I said, I can't do them by tomorrow. And then Bill, and he was with the FBI, he was always with Bobby on the trips, said when Bobby was on campaign, he'd love to sing, and he'd get everybody singing, you know, in the bus or in the train or something. And he loved Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mm-hmm. And Ethel said, can you do that? And I said, yeah, that I can do. She
perfect
said, well,
that'll
be it.
Perfect choice.
But as it turns out, it was really perfect, because so thrilling that outside the cathedral, all up and down Madison Avenue and all up and down Fifth Avenue, thousands of people, and it was speakers were blaring. Everybody along those avenues were singing. It was just incredible. And everybody in the St. Patrick's sang along too near the end. There was obviously a choir that. That was the other thing. I had to figure out the key from the music that was from before that. I guess I could have had a pitch pipe or something, but I didn't. Mm. So I figured out with the music beforehand what I had to do to get it in the right key to start singing, because the choir didn't come in until later. Fortunately, I picked the right key. Could have been a disaster. Could have been a train wreck if they'd come in a different key than I was started it.
Let's go to Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Jean. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you. My call is prompted by a memory of perhaps 40 years ago. I lived in a nice suburb of Dayton, and I hope I'm correct in my memories about this. I think Andy Williams came to play in a golf tournament, a benefit called Bogey Busters, and there was a party hosted by the Lauders, who lived in the same neighborhood as I did with my family. We were a young family, and there were many, many, dozens, I think, young grade school, junior high, early high school kids in that neighborhood, and we got word that Andy Williams was at the Lauders' house. So it was a warm summer evening, and I wondered what in the world these kids were doing, riding the bikes up and down the street and wandering up and down the street, and they were all up there trying to get a glimpse of Andy Williams at the Lauders' house.
I just talked to Cy Lauder 2 days ago, and he and Audrey are doing all right. They're not in great health, but they're still with us. And yeah, I was there, and I've played in the Bogey Buster several years, or at least two, I know.
You know, there is the movie Love Story that another movie whose song you recorded. Really an incredible song.
Where do I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be? The sweet love story that is older than the sea. The simple truth
about the love she brings to me. Where do I start? With her first hello, she gave a meaning to this empty world of mine. There'd never be another love, another time. She came into my life and made the living fine. She fills my heart. Special things with angel songs, with wild imaginings. She fills my soul with so much love that anywhere I go, I'm never lonely with her alone. Who could be lonely? I reach for her hand, it's always there.
At first, I thought that was an arrangement by Henry Mancini.
I don't think he wrote it. I can't remember for sure.
It's so beautiful.
It is a gorgeous thing. It was the biggest record I ever had.
Really?
Biggest single record. The movie was so popular around the world that I recorded it in 6 different languages.
The range of your voice.
Yeah, that wasn't an easy song to sing.
And just to remind, Andy Williams is with me, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go, finally, to Nancy in Baltimore, Maryland. Quick comment, please.
Thank you. What a gift to hear both of you. 10 years ago, I went to Branson, where my son was living and working, and it was Thanksgiving, and we got tickets to see you, Andy Williams, at your show, your Christmas show. The theater was so elegant. The kimono were beautiful, and your show is so wholesome and fine, and you are so down to earth. My impression of you is that you are a gentleman and a real gentleman.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. I'm glad you saw that show. I'm glad that you like the theater. It is a really lovely theater.
And we should say that the kind of success you have achieved has not come without a lot of costs, personally.
Well, it's been a long journey, and it hasn't been all ups. You know, there have been some downs. There's been some tragedy in my life with my ex-wife Claudine's trial and stuff for shooting and killing Spider Savage, the accidental shooting, I should say. And then, as I mentioned before, the Bobby Kennedy thing was. But most of my life has been. Had some highs in it.
I'm glad. I'm so glad you were here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I was here, too. I'm delighted to have met you.
Thank you. Delighted to meet you. Andy Williams, his new memoir is titled Moon River and Me.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling out in the snow. There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago. It's the most wonderful time of the year.